our speaker. Please help me welcome Chris S. from New Jersey.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. It's really a wonderful honor to be up here in Canada. I've had a really good time so far. There were some amazing speakers today. It was just great, great being here. Ernie, my host, thank you for everything you've done. And one of the very special things about coming up here is my good friends Jeff and Diane, who I've been able to stay with since I'm up here. Very, very dear friends, and it was great being able to catch up with them. I've been treated so well since I've been here. Our table was called first for dinner, and that was very, very nice. And halfway through my potato, I heard the slug announcer. How many real alcoholics in here ate the potatoes anyway? All right, yeah, look at that. Let the record show more than half. Okay. I know the guy a little bit who was cooking. I'm not worried. Anyway. It's a great pleasure to be here. I am an alcoholic. I understand a little bit more about alcoholism today than I did when I first came in, and I'm glad for that. Alcoholism is an aggressive illness. It affects every area of your life. When you're in an unrecovered state, you are really, every bit of quality of your life is being affected in a negative way. And I didn't really understand that when I first came in. I thought I had a drinking problem. I thought that, you get the booze away from me, and I'll be able to maintain, I'll be able to handle things pretty well. Well, that's really not what happened. I'm going to go back to the beginning. We've heard some great speakers talk about their experience of what it was like when they were young and feeling apart from or different then. What really sticks out in my mind is the day my mother put me in a car, drove me across town, and said, "This is your first day of kindergarten. Get out." All right, and I'm thinking, this is a mistake. This can't be right. Something very fundamental is wrong here. Because I got out of the car and I stood up on the hill, and there was the schoolhouse, and kids were already playing kickball and tag. And I was standing up on the hill looking down, feeling like an idiot. I had all this self-centered feel, like, what if I'm not going to fit in? What if they make fun of me? How am I supposed to make friends? Why did they do this to me? I was happy back at the house. And I recognized the fact that I needed to walk down that hill, and I needed to be a kindergartner, but I was terrified. And I did that. I acted as if everything was okay inside of me, and I walked down the hill and I started to do the kindergarten thing. Now, I recognize that uncomfortability with myself and my environment. That's one of the ways alcoholism presents, I believe. It presents in many, many different ways. But that's one of the ways it was presenting in me. And I know that because if I would have had a half a pint of vodka, walking down that hill, everything would have been fine. I'd have been the kindergarten kid. You know what I mean? I would have been the coolest kindergartner in that class. But I didn't have that magic elixir called alcohol. The problem was they weren't serving five-year-olds at that time. And, it took me a long while to find something that would give me that sense of ease and comfort. I'm in eighth grade or something, and I decided with a couple of my buddies to cut school. We're going to cut school and go back to my house and get drunk. Now, none of us have ever been drunk before, but it sounds like a cool thing to do. We'll be able to brag about it at school the next day. And that's what we did. We went to my house, and I pulled down a bottle of Four Roses whiskey. And there was dust on it. No one really drank that much at my house. Some beer. But I poured it down. I didn't know how to drink it. I poured three big water glasses filled with this Four Roses whiskey. And the two guys I was with, let me tell you what happened with them first. They had about two-thirds of their glass, and they'd had enough. You ever drink with people like that? They have enough on you? You know what I mean? No more for me, thanks. I got to go home to the little lady. Are you crazy? It's only 10 o'clock. Let's go to the city. That's how I drank. You know, so these guys had enough, and they sat back and they watched the show. Because what happened with me was I drank my whole glass, the rest of their glasses, and the rest of the bottle, and I went into my first blackout. Any blackout drinkers in here? That's unnerving, isn't it? You know, going into a blackout. You might not have any I nevers. You know, think about that. But I went to my first blackout. I'm about 13 years old, and I wake up in a field, and I go back to my house, and the house is trashed, and I feel unbelievably terrible. But you know, remember that first hangover, like when you got really drunk, you had to be horizontal for 2 days. You were just illing, you know, this whole time I'm really sick, and I heard that I did some stupid things, and you know, I was mortified pretty much and scared. But I'll tell you what that alcohol did for me before I went into the blackout. That scared kindergartner, that alcohol took that fear away. It was the anti-crisp potion I'd been looking for my whole life. All of a sudden, I felt cool, and I wasn't worried about what you thought of me. I used to be just preoccupied with, what's he thinking about me? You know? And for the first time in my life, I wasn't worried about a whole bunch of emotional garbage that had followed me around since childhood. So, you know, with the alcoholic very, very quickly starts to forget the bad times, but always hangs on to the good things. And I hung on to this. I had found a solution to the problem, my emotional problems. And I started to become preoccupied with alcohol after that. I knew not to drink Four Roses whiskey straight, but you know, I started to experiment with the different kinds of alcohol. You know, the kid alcohols like Boone's Farm Apple Wine, you know, and Ripple and stuff. And I started to drink beer. And I started to become very, very preoccupied with alcohol. Now, you know, this is at a pretty young age. 13 or 14 is pretty young. And from what I've learned today, you know, getting involved in drugs and alcohol at that kind of an age is pretty destructive for someone's character. But I started to drink whenever I could arrange it. And it started to become paramount in my life. It's not like I recognized this, but I planned my day around where I was going to get alcohol, who I was going to drink with, you know, where was it going to be, what kind of alcohol was it. I started to think about this a lot, and it became very, very important for me. And I started to not pay too much attention in school, and you know, I started to get in trouble. And alcohol really had a hold on me before I even knew alcohol had a hold on me. And my, you know, like I said, my grades started to slip. I never said to myself, oh my God, I'm getting preoccupied with alcohol. If I keep on like this, you know, my grades will slip so bad that I may not get into the college of my choice. I mean, that did not dawn on me. You know, what I would say if you gave me a hard time about my drinking was, get off my back. Leave me alone. It, you know, it's my business. I'm only hurting me. The war cry of the alcoholic. Now, around this time, this is the late 60s, early 70s, so there were some other substances that were in abundance, especially in North Jersey at this time, and I partook, you know. I mean, I was non-discriminatory as far as that was concerned, and I got into some trouble with some of that stuff. I remember the great Quaalude epidemic of 1972, okay? This is Ridge High School in New Jersey. A friend of mine comes into school, and we'd have a smoking area where we all trade things back and forth, you know, before we had to go to high school. And this guy brings a big sack of Quaaludes in and throws them down and says, I got Quaaludes. Now, none of us have ever heard of these before. You know, the two questions are, how much are they and how many do we take? You know, so he goes, oh, they're a dollar each and take two or three. I mean, he'd never taken any of these before, right? So we're taking two and three and four of these before first period of high school. Now, like 50 of us. Now, you know, some people understand, you know, what that means. If you don't, a And quaalude was a very, very strong pill. If you took one quaalude, it's like drinking a 12-pack of tall boys in like 5 minutes, you know? And so it noodled us all up. And the ambulance is coming in, you know, like all day long. And the last thing I remember is like walking down the hall to third period, hanging on to the lockers like this. I got to make a break for it. You know, I can't deal with this. And I see the exit sign, and I just head for it. I'm gonna go across the field and get to the woods. Just get to the woods and hug a tree for a while, and you'll be okay. But what doesn't dawn on me is I went past the whole 400 wing of, you know, like 500 students. And the next day they were all laughing and saying, "Chris, it was beautiful. It took you 5 minutes to get 100 yards, you know?" I thought I was moving too, you know? Oh. And then there was the crazy drugs, which were just bizarre, like LSD. I'd be drunk, and a lot of times I'd do these drugs drunk, you know, because it kind of, you know, okay, you know, it's, you know, it sounds good. And I remember this one time we took way too much at this concert in New York City. We thought we got ripped off because 5 minutes later, you know, nothing was happening. So we bought more. And then 10 minutes later, nothing was happening. So we bought more. You know, by the end of the concert, it's like, you know, it's like a virtual Disneyland, you know. And we struggle out to the van to go back to New Jersey. And we're all in the van and we're all driving back to New Jersey, you know, on high alert. And if anybody's familiar with the Lincoln Tunnel, what happens is there's like about 10 lanes, and they all narrow down into 2 lanes, and then you go into the tunnel. And we're headed down toward the tunnel, and somebody in the front of the van goes, "Hey, man, we'll never fit." You know? And we get all concerned, and, you know, we move to the front of the van, and he's like, "He's right! You know, we're not going to fit." So we're backing out, you know, everybody's honking at us. It took us like 45 minutes to back out. You know, we took the bridge after that. It was a little more broad, roomy, and all-inclusive. But, you know, so these kind of problems were happening all the time. And you know, it was all about, you know, the party, get high. And, you know, there was some fun in the beginning in my drinking. You know, I was a blackout drinker from day one, but, you know, there was a little bit of control that I could exert in the beginning by just drinking beer or, you know, pacing myself. For a very short period of time, I was able to do that. And there was some fun in there. And the thing about alcoholism is it's slow. Sometimes the progression is so slow you don't notice that your life is getting really bad. You know, every single month it's a little worse. Every single year it's a little worse. And that was what was happening with me. And I just didn't know any better. And alcohol was really becoming my master before I even understood that was happening. Now, I had some real problems with drinking. If you're a blackout drinker, if you just drink to get completely trashed, you know, some bad things happen to you. And I had some problems with the Motor Vehicle Bureau. I came from a time when friends let friends drive drunk. I mean, that was just the way it was back in the day. You know, you get drunk at the party and you walk there and you go home and you get the car. I had some DUIs. The first accident I had, I was actually killed. I drove through a telephone pole, and, you know, when the cops got there, CPR, you know, and I went flatline in the ambulance again, and they hit me with the hooters, you know, clear. You know, and they bring me back, and I wake up in the hospital with my head bandaged and my ribs are all bandaged up. And I got out of there about 3 days later. You know what the first thing I did was? I went to the liquor store to get some booze to go down to the park and drink. So I would, you know, I didn't think about this, but I'd be drinking and driving that night. You know, it wasn't like I thought, like, maybe I shouldn't drink and drive. That's not something that even dawned on me. You know, by the time I had my third DUI, the thought crossed my mind that I've got to stop driving. You know, stopping drinking wasn't in it. It wasn't an option for me. But here's a story of my first DUI. I'm way out at this bar, and you know they're doing country music and dancing and stuff way out in the country, and I'm there, and we're chugging pitchers of beer. Now that's social drinking for you, right? And it gets messy too after a while, chugging pitchers of beer. And the last thing I remember is it's a middleware, and I'm driving home, and the car hits some black ice, turns around, spins around, and I hit a bridge abutment going backwards at about 35 miles an hour. And I get thrown out the back window. I remember looking up at the sky. My legs are still in the car, and I'm laying on the trunk looking up at the sky. You know, and I get off of the car, and it's actually still running. Okay, so what do you do? Where are you going to go? You got this homing instinct, right? I'm going home. Now it's got three flat tires. There's not a window left in the car. It's bent like a boomerang. The drive shaft is slapping the frame, and I'm driving home. And literally, I'm going, boogada back and a wham, boogada back and a wham, about like 2 miles an hour. And I drive by a cop giving radar. He didn't even pull me over. He walked me over. You know what I mean? And I remember he grabbed me through the missing window and started shaking me. Where'd you have that accident? I'm like, what accident, officer? There's like glass flying out of my hair. And, DUI number one, DUI number two was down in Florida. By this time, I learned to drive big clunker $100 Quaalude cars, right? Because they're disposable, and if the bigger they are, the more they bounce off things. And I'm in this 62 Buick LeSabre, and I left the party early. Got in an argument with somebody or something, and I'm totally in a blackout. And this is, so they say, because I have a piece this all together, you ever know people that like really pay attention to their yards? You know, they're out there like pulling the weeds and clipping the bushes and stuff. I had to pick one of those guys to drive up on his lawn. I drove up on his lawn, I ran over one of his trees. It was like one of the ornamental trees, and it got stuck under the car, and I went back out on the road with his tree under my car. And because he's one of these guys that really cares about his lawn and everything, he calls the police on me. And the police get there, and they follow the trail of dirt. I'm about 20 blocks down the road, sleeping, with the tree still under my car. So I wake up in jail, not even knowing how I got there, because it was all black. I'm like, I'm in jail. And I found out that you don't wake up your bunkmate and ask him why you're there. Okay, I guess it's one of those jailhouse things, because he got really angry. And I didn't know why I was in there until the judge was sentencing me. It was really bizarre. I'll tell you my last DUI story. A friend came home, came back from Florida and visiting me in New Jersey. He hadn't seen me in a while, and he made the mistake of saying, "Hey, Chris, you want to go out for some drinks?" This wasn't something most people who knew me would do. So we went out and we were drinking, and I got blitzed like in the first half hour. That was always my problem. I'd get too drunk too quick. And we went to this bar. And I remember walking in. I wasn't a great bar drinker because I got too drunk. I mean, I would pass out on the bar. Bartenders hate that, Or I'd get into a fight or, some terrible thing would happen. But anyway, we're at this bar, and I remember sitting at the bar, and the bartender comes up to me and goes, "What are you having?" And I said, "Bartender, I gotta be honest. If I was you, I wouldn't serve me." And he goes, "Well, why is that?" I go, "Because I'm drunk out of my mind." And he goes, "Well, for being so honest, what are you having? It's on the house." So I go, "Triple bourbon and coke." And he fills this big glass up with bourbon, and there's about like a quarter inch left for the coke, and he's got the spritzer, and he's looking at me, and I go, "Yeah." And he goes, like this. And I start drinking this with vengeance, and I start looking around, and all of a sudden I notice that there's a table of four very lovely women right over there all by themselves who would probably really benefit from my company at this point in time. So I got up and I start staggering that direction. And I remember they all looked at me at once with the same expression. It was like, you know, it's coming our way, you know. And I get almost to their table and I trip on my feet and I fall on their table and knock all their drinks in their lap, you know, like real class. And my buddies grab me and take me out and put me in the truck. And I remember being at the guy's house later that night because I got in an argument or something. I was going to stay there. I get in an argument. I've got to leave. And I'm driving home. It's about a 10-mile drive. Now, supposedly, I crossed the double yellow. You know how cops are, right? So supposedly, I'm right in my town. I'm almost home. And he pulls me over, and I roll down the window, like, "What is really wild?" And it's license, registration, insurance card. So I'm leaning over, and I open up the glove compartment, and there's, you know, I'm looking, and I'm just, it's hard to, you know, it's all this stuff. But I just give up, and I grab the entire contents of the glove compartment, and I hand it to the cop. There's maps and brushes and, you know, tissues and pens and the license, the registration, insurance goes in there somewhere, you know. And, of course, out of the car, you know. It gives me a field sobriety and takes me to the police station. Now, anybody remember hazy recollections? Like when you're drinking, like you remember little bits and pieces of the night before, but not much. Right. I remember that during the test, I did a good job on the ABCs. This is what I remember, okay? So I hire an attorney because they give me a ticket. I hire an attorney. We're going to fight this injustice, you know? They had no right to pull me over. Double yellow. Anyway, I hire this $1,500 attorney, and we show up at the police station, and the first thing you need to do is look at the video. Because they video your sobriety. Has anybody in here ever seen your video? Okay, don't. Don't, all right? You'll need massive therapy. And it's so disturbing. Anyway, you know, I thought I did a good job. Well, they take the tape and they put it in. And I should have known, because when the cop gave the tape to my lawyer, he, like, sniggered. He went like... You know, they must have been watching it, you know, for entertainment for the last 6 months. Anyway, my lawyer puts it into the TV and turns it on, and I'm like immediately horrified. I am really, really drunk. Yeah, and, you know, we get to the ABCs. The whole time, this $1,500 lawyer, really, you know, really professional and proper and taking notes. And I'm just horrified because we get to the ABCs, and I got the ABCs right, but this is how I did them. Can I have a cigarette? And I'm like, oh, no. There's actual video of me hanging onto the wall while I'm walking the straight line. And, you know, they're like, no, sir, you can't hang onto the wall or the officer while you're walking the line. And it's really bad. It's really bad. And I'm totally humiliated. And at the end of this torture, what happens is the cop goes, "We're about to turn off the camera. Would you like to add anything before we turn off the camera?" And I look over at the camera and I go, like this. I'm like, oh! The lawyer's been holding it together the whole time, right? Right, finally he goes, "Wah!" He's laughing, he's going, "I've never seen anything so stupid in my life, never." He goes, "If you had any hope of, you know, beating this, you just blew it, blah, ha, ha, ha," you know. And I'm like, well, I guess we'll plead this one, you know. Oh. So I walked for 4 years, you know, cut into my dating a little bit, you know. Alcoholism is so destructive. It's like the unrequited lover, you know what I mean? It's like I thought alcohol was the one thing that was holding me together, was the one thing that I could count on. Everybody else let me down. you know, there was bad cops and the family, you know, didn't understand me, and my friends weren't good friends, and, you know, ungrateful women, you know. I mean, you name it, and that's what my problem was, and I would sit there and I would talk to the bottle, you know, and it's just you and me, you know. I mean, it was like the most unrequited love affair that you could ever have, because it was an illusion. Alcohol was somewhat of a solution to my spiritual condition, to the emotional trauma that I had since childhood, but it was a bad solution. It was a solution that would boomerang on me. Now, I had moved out to Florida for a while to go to school. Anybody in here good starters? You're like really good at starting stuff, but there's like not so much follow-through. I mean, I went to college, I spent 3.5 years, I got 6 credits, okay, you know, I would take guitar lessons, I'd take 2 lessons and quit, you know, I joined the Boy Scouts, I went on 1 camp out, I mean, it's just in my nature to just kind of lose the enthusiasm for whatever the heck I'm doing, and I think that's another way that that alcoholism presents. But anyway, I'm down in Florida, and the cops are looking for me. I haven't done my community service. I haven't paid any of my fines. You know, I'm supposed to do all this stuff. The landlord's looking for the money. There's ambulance bills that are due, you know, because of accidents that I've been in. And you know, the thought crosses my mind that Mom could use a little help around the house back in New Jersey. You know, So I moved back to New Jersey because I'm only going to stay there 8 years in my mother's house, the worst 8 years of my drinking, and burn it down a couple of times, and oh, it was just, she just couldn't kick me out, you know? But life really, really got grim, you know? My wife had left me. I was having one bad job after the other. Somewhere while I was drinking, I became an electrician. Okay? It's a really bad trade to be in when you shake like this. And you're really ice chugging. You know, things blow up. And I was constantly doing crazy things. I would accidentally drill down into somebody's closet, and, you know, we'd look and we'd open up the doors and there'd be like 20 suits covered with plaster, one of them coiled up into the suit. Sorry! You know, another time I wired the sub panel to the wrong meter for a kitchen addition, and I wired it to the hot water heater meter. So that's great, except the kitchen comes on at 8 at night and goes off at 6 in the morning. And they complained to my boss that, you know, they eat at 6. This is unacceptable. So I'd be getting into trouble all the time. The worst thing I think that happened to me when I was an electrician is I'm working in this place called Epstein's. It was like a Macy's, one of those pretty high-class department stores. And what I was doing was I was wiring the computer cash registers in. And this is when they first came out. And you have to daisy-chain the computer wire. And a lot of these cash registers are out on these islands. So you have to drill through the floor and then climb into the ceiling below and drag these wires around. So I've got this auger bit on a big, huge drill with an extension, you know, and I'm drilling, and I'm in the lingerie section, and I'm getting preoccupied a little bit. I mean, you know, there's like some interesting stuff going on here, and I'm not really paying attention, and it's a big, huge half-horsepower drill with the rebar handles and the locking trigger, and all of a sudden it hits a beam, and it jams, and I like bear down on it and accidentally lock the trigger, and it starts twisting me around like this, and it twisted and it tied me up in the cord to the drill while it was spinning me around, and until it finally unplugged from the wall, and the auger bit ripped the pants off my ass. So in the middle of the lingerie section, I'm tied to a drill with no pants, all bloodied up, going like this. And if it's one thing we can't stand, it's to look stupid, you know? We do not want to look stupid. Oh, yeah, this always happens with this drill, you know? Oh. So I was like bad at what I did, and I was always worried that somebody was going to find me out. Like, somebody was going to come to me and go, Chris, Christian, not an electrician. I'm scared somebody's going to say that because I'm really not, you know. Been doing it for 10 years and still don't know what I'm doing. So all I'm doing is drinking. Now, let me give you a brief look at what one day in the last 4 years of my drinking looked like. I would come to in the morning in the clothes that I had passed out in the night before, and I'd have to be at work at 8 o'clock, and the alarm would go off at like 7:30. So I'd like stagger up. You know. I'd go into the bathroom and do my vomiting calisthenics, you know, because so I was a smoker and a drinker. So you got to vomit every blah, blah, blah. And then I'd brush my teeth, you know, and I'd stagger out to the car, and it was usually a $100 car, and I'd get in the car and I'd head for work, and I would be ringing. I would have. It's not even a hangover. What it really is you're poisoning your body. And this is a reaction. Your body is kind of used to being poisoned, but it's still not happy with it. And then, you know, my head is ringing, you know, hyper acuity, I'm driving to work. And the first thing I do is I swear to myself, I am never going to do this again. I'm never going to drink again, ever. Now, if there was a polygraph expert that would hook up his machine to me and ask me, Chris, are you ever going to drink again? No! The polygraph experts say, he's telling the truth. This guy's never going to drink again. Because I meant it. You know, in the morning when I was feeling horrible, I meant it. I was going to give alcohol up. Now, I'd get to work, and, you know, the boss would tell me to do 3 or 4 things, and I'd get halfway out of the parking lot, and I'd say, what the hell did he tell me to do? You know, I'd have to go back and go, what was all that? You know, go on there. I told you to write things down. You know, he'd yell at me. So I get off to the job site, you know, and I'd be pulling wires and blowing things up. And it would come to about lunchtime where I'd send out a guy to get me a sandwich and something to drink, you know, because you're always rehydrating. And finally, somewhere around 1 o'clock, I'd start to feel a little bit human because I had a little food in me, I'm rehydrated, I'd start to feel a little human. And I'd say to myself, you know that decision you made this morning about never drinking again? That's a pretty strong position to take. You know? That might be an overreaction, really, to this whole thing. We may have to modify that decision today. And I would stop at the liquor store on the way home and buy another quart of vodka or bourbon and start the whole cycle up. And on the weekends, I would drink round the clock. I would get toasted out drunk until I passed out. When I came to, I'd start drinking again until I passed out, and then I'd come to, and I'd start drinking again, and you know, the nights and the days would blur together in that Twilight Zone-esque type of existence, and somewhere around Sunday afternoon, I realized I need to start pulling myself out of this a little bit, or I'm not going to be able to get to work Monday morning, and sometimes I'd be able to do it, and sometimes I wouldn't. Now, this is a horrible way to exist. You know, when you think about it, what you're doing is you're poisoning yourself purposefully, you know, time after time after time. What I was caught up in, which I didn't really understand, was the powerlessness over alcohol. How it manifests in me is the physical craving is part of the first step. The physical craving is basically the first drink always does one thing. It asks for the second. The second insists on the third demands the fourth. By the time I'm having the 14th, I want that more than I wanted the 13th. Because the alcohol creates a phenomenon of craving, a physiological craving for more alcohol. That happens with alcoholics. The other part of the first step, which is tougher for, it was tougher for me to understand, because there's a great line in step one, in the 12 and 12. Who among us wishes to admit complete defeat? Glass in hand, we've warped our minds to such a state that only an act of divine providence can relieve us of our obsession. Do you know what that's saying? That's saying that you're doomed unless God shines through the clouds on you. That's basically what that sentence says. Now, who among us wishes to admit that type of defeat? The ego doesn't want to say it can't do anything about this. that it's powerless. So that obsession of the mind, that powerlessness overtaking the first drink, was something very, very hard for me to grasp. It was very difficult for me to grasp. Now, when the time came and I started to check myself into outpatient and I started to check myself into detox and I actually started to show up at some AA meetings, alcohol had got my attention to the point where I knew I was going to die if I keep on like this. You can't continue to drink like that without blowing something out. So I was signing myself into treatment centers and stuff. Here's where I really learned about powerlessness. I had been through outpatient, signed myself in there. I signed myself into a 28-day program. Everyone else in that program was there because of DUIs or bosses or whatever. They were there because of pressure. I was like the only person that, you know, self-admitted, I signed myself in here because I need to separate from alcohol. So I was serious about it. I didn't want to go to rehab. I don't like to be cooped up in a place and told what to do and you got to make your bed. I don't make beds. You know, I mean, that was my attitude. So I didn't want to be there. And then I didn't want to go to AA when I got out. I did it because I was desperate to separate from alcohol. I knew it was killing me. It finally dawned on me that alcohol is killing me. And I was real serious about this not drinking stuff. Enough to pay $13,000 for a rehab and go to AA and outpatient and all this other stuff. Well, one day, I'm on the way to an AA meeting, and the thought crosses my mind that, you know, you've been sober almost 90 days now. You know, I don't even know if I can really say I remember what it's like to be drunk. It's been so long. I'll bet if I buy a gallon of vodka and drink it, it will reinvigorate this whole recovery thing. You know, in other words, it'll make me feel so bad, I'll burst back into those AA meetings, you know, with renewed enthusiasm. Now, this is one of the reasons why you get a sponsor. You know what I'm saying? If you're a newcomer and you've got a plan, share your plan with your sponsor, please, because here's what happened. I really thought this was a good plan. And I went back home with a gallon of vodka and I started to drink it. Now, drink number one. Good idea. Drink number two, doing the right thing. Drink number three, oh my God, what have I done? I'm drunk again. I've opened up the cage door to the beast, and I'm going to be dragged around like a rag doll for who knows how long this is going to go on. This is horrible. How did I do this? Now, here's what I realized. I realized that they talk about insanity in step two. A power greater than ourselves needs to restore us to sanity. Well, when was I insane? Drinking or sober that day? The insanity hit me sober. I've always taken the first drink sober. You know what I'm saying? That's the problem. Quitting drinking isn't the problem. Starting up again is. Up until that point in time, I was never able to make a firm decision to stay away from alcohol and have it mean anything. I can have the best of intentions. I can swear to on the Bible. I can understand that I'll die if I drink again. I can understand that I'll be put in prison if I drink again. And none of those things are going to stop me from drinking because of the obsession of the mind. This is a characteristic and one of the ways alcoholism presents. So when they say only an act of divine providence will be able to relieve you of your obsession, you know, I understand that today. God could and would if he was sought. Now, that drunk lasted about 5 months. At the very end of this 5 months, it's Christmas at my mother's, because I'm still living there, okay? My brother and sister are there, nieces and nephews, you know, family animals. And, you know, the carols are playing on the stereo, and the Christmas tree is all decked out with the presents, and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care. You know, everybody's just loving each other, and I start to drink Johnny Walker Black. Because that's my Christmas drink, okay? And I go into a violent blackout where I threaten all their lives. I'm going to kill all of you! you know, and this wasn't the festive mood everybody was looking for. So they picked up Christmas and they headed elsewhere, thank you, okay? Now, what's upstate New York? Now, I come to, you know, the presents are gone, and, you know, like, whoa, what happened? I was on like a 4-day blackout, really ugly. And, you know, I start to detox right away. I mean, at this point in time, I need medical attention for detoxing. And I go into the kitchen to get some water or something, and I see a pile of vodka bottles in the sink like this high. I don't even remember buying them. I must have been staggering uptown, you know, buying vodka bottles for days. And I was in a complete blackout. Now, you know, I I'm shattered. This is the detox to end all detoxes. I am absolutely shattered. I'm seeing things. There's like little animals running around, and there's things scratching on the house to get in, and, you know, and I'm hearing marching bands. You know, but whenever I'm sitting next to a newcomer and there's music coming from somewhere, I'll go, I can hear it too. You know what I mean? Because I know that feeling. Where's a marching band come from? So, and I'm freaking out. And I remember this. I remember about 2 days into it, I'm laying down on the couch, and I'm just looking up at the ceiling, and a demon comes out of the ceiling, like one of those real demons with the bull head and the horns, and he's coming down to eat my face. And I'm like, ah! I just totally freak out. And I go, God help me, you know. I mean, it came from the deepest part of my soul. It was a cry of humility, a desperate pleading, you know, because I didn't want this thing to eat my face, and I didn't want to live like this anymore, you know. And I got to tell you, I haven't had a drink since that desperate prayer. But what happened is, you know, I finally got through this detox. You know why I didn't go to the hospital or call the ambulance? So I didn't want to look stupid. Okay, so I'll take my chances on blowing an aorta during the detox, because I don't want the ambulance people to go, oh, look, here's some lame alcoholic we got to take to, you know. I couldn't have taken that, you know, so I'll just die on my own. You know? But that year, you remember that movie? And I was just looping it and just watching it, you know, because I knew somehow. I'd been to treatment, I'd been to outpatient, I'd had the counselors, I'd had the shrinking, I had all that. I knew my answer was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just knew that deep down in my soul. I hadn't gone in there with enough enthusiastic participation. So this, as soon as I can leave the house, you know, without freaking out, I'm headed to a meeting. I haven't slept in 5 days. And I'm looking in the book for meetings. And I had a 1976 Ford Granada with right walls, no clutch, no emergency brake, no heater core, okay, busted up corner panels, no muffler. This thing is the 'cause I was busy all the time. I didn't have time to, like, work on a car. You know, I was drinking all the time. So this thing was barely running. So I'm looking in the book. I have to find a flat meeting. I can't just go to any meeting. It's got to be flat getting there because I've got no clutch in the thing. So I find a flat meeting in Morristown, and I'm on my way. Now, it's pretty flat to get there, but there's this little hill that you have to go up by the church, right past where everybody's smoking cigarettes to get into the back parking lot. And I remember I'm trying to make it up this hill with no clutch, and I have to just floor it, and it's got no muffler. So I'm like, wah! And I'm going about 1 mile an hour, and everybody's like looking, must be a new guy, you know? And I was. I had to park it against a tree because there was no emergency brake, no clutch, so it would roll. So I park it against the tree. And I walk in, you know, and I sit down. I'm sitting down toward the back. And, you know, by this time the meeting has started and somebody's talking. And then somebody hands me a step book. They go, here, we're reading from step 12. And I grab the book and I look down the road. And they are. They're coming down the row at me. I'm going to have to read something. I haven't slept in like 5 days. I'm shaking. I got the things upside down. I'm like, I'm going to have to read. And so what do you do? I got up and split. and I'm standing outside thinking, you know, this AA thing, this is just too much, you know. We're here. Norm Alpey used to always say, we're here by seconds and inches. We all are. We're here by seconds and inches. And this is just one of the cases where I was there by seconds and inches. I am standing on the porch considering whether I can do AA or whether I need to go drink myself to death. And I'm thinking about it because, you know, it's a real decision I need to make. And I'm sitting there, and this guy, I'll never forget, this guy, Jorge, saw me get up and leave and followed me out. And he comes up to me and he goes, "Hi, my name's Jorge, you know, what's your deal?" And I'm like, "Oh, it's crazy, this relapses, my monsters, magazines, it's terrible." And he goes, "Well, why don't you come on back in the meeting?" And I'm like, "Well, it's a meeting tomorrow night. It's a meeting tomorrow night. Everybody goes there tomorrow. I'll go tomorrow." And he knew what tomorrow meant. We know what it means when somebody says tomorrow. That means like never. So he grabs me by the arm, and, you know, I don't want to make a scene, so I go in with him. And by this time, the only seats left are in the second row. And we sit down, and at least thank God they've stopped reading. You know, so I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to the, you know, somebody sharing something, you know, made no sense to me, and I'm sitting there, and he leans over and he goes, "Okay, raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." You know, yeah, but, you know, I need people looking at me like I need a bullet through my head. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, "There's a meeting tomorrow night, and everybody raises their hand, and everybody's going, I'm gonna do it tomorrow." And he goes, he starts to get loud. He starts going, "Raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." So I've never seen this done before. I never seen it done after. But right in the middle of some woman sharing on step 12, I raised my hand like this, right in the middle of her talking. And the chairperson is looking at me and concerned, so the chairperson shuts the woman up and calls on me. And I remember, you know, I share something like, thank you. And it was dead quiet. Everybody's like, and then all of a sudden, they all start cheering. They're going, "Yay!" And they're clapping for me. Now, I kind of took that as like acceptance. You know, today I know what that is. It's like, "You poor, pathetic bastard. You know, thank you so much. I thought I had problems. Oh, I feel so much better." You know, I mean, that's what it is. But I took it as acceptance. So, now, here's what this did for me. Here's the second sentence. Here's what Jorge did for me. I had so much self-centered fear built up. There was a wall of self-centered fear that was going to keep me from getting into Alcoholics Anonymous and doing the work that was going to help me participate in the maintenance of my spiritual condition, to put me in the sunlight of the Spirit where God could shine down and give me His divine providence. Okay, that's the way I look at it today. I need to participate in my spiritual condition, but the Father of Light is the one that has the power to relieve me of this obsession. But if I'm not there, if I'm not participating, it's not going to happen. So what happened is raising my hand and telling these people that I was coming back was a heroic move for me with the amount of self-centered fear that I had. And by doing that, I knocked a little of that wall down that was keeping me from coming in to AA. Now, I start going to meetings like a maniac, okay? I am desperate. I have a willingness that's born of desperation. I mean, when you threaten your family with a .38 caliber handgun in a blackout over Christmas and you're going to kill them all, that should get your attention. Because I had some fondness for my family. You know what I mean? And I didn't want to go to prison, you know, or the mental asylum. So, I mean, I had a willingness born of desperation, and I started to go to AA. And I didn't know a lot about AA, you know, and when I talk about AA, I'm talking about a small area in North Jersey where I went to meetings. AA is it's different in so many different places. There's so many different experiences that people have. You know, I'm inclusive and not exclusive, but this is what was going on in my particular area. It was a fellowship-based process in AA, and there was very little recovery. What I mean by that is it fostered meeting dependence in my area. In other words, if you got something going on in your life, double up on your meetings, okay? You know, share more, you know? Dump more of your problems out on the table for everybody else to have to deal with. That's really what was encouraged, you know, go to a lot of meetings. And listen, I love the fellowship. I absolutely love the fellowship. Without the fellowship, nothing would have been possible for me. Nothing would have been possible for me. But you don't treat alcoholism by going to meetings. That's not the treatment for alcoholism. The 12 steps is the treatment for alcoholism. Now, here's my experience. I am going to 13 meetings a week. I'm the coffee maker over here, you know, till the grinds are coming out of my ears. I'm the secretary over here, the treasurer. You know, I'm going to the diner afterward. I'm taking people, picking people up. I mean, I'm as active as I can possibly be. And this lasts about a year and a half. Now, I'm sober, okay, but all of the emotional problems that I had when I was drinking are still on me. I am still that scared kindergartner, you know what I mean? I still am dealing with emotional and mental and psychic trauma, and I'm just keeping quiet about it. You know, someone will come up to me and say, "Hey, Chris, you look like you're doing pretty good. How's everything going?" Great. Fine. I knew I couldn't get gut level honest and say, "Well, I'm having fantasies of homicidal rage, and you know, I'm thinking about getting an automatic weapon and climbing a tower." How are you doing? I mean, you know, that doesn't go over very well in the loony noony on Thursday, you know, in my area. So I'd say, "Great, fine," but meanwhile, I'm like an inferno of emotional stress and anxiety, and I'm just going to meetings. It's keeping me sober. Now, what happened was, this guy that I used to hang out with is called Radio Shack Mike, and he'd give me tapes every once in a while. I remember he gave me this set of affirmation tapes, and you're supposed to take it home and you're supposed to play these affirmations. So he'd go to any New Age bookstore and buy anything, you know, get sober through pyramids and crystals. I mean, he was all inclusive, you know. He was totally into anything, and he gave me these affirmation tapes, and I went home and I put them in and I stood in front of the mirror, and you're supposed to say 100 times, "Chris, you're a wonderful guy." So I remember looking in the mirror, "Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. I'm a scumbag," you know, and throwing these things away. It just, you know, would not work. Now, you know, a lot of things in hindsight, looking back on it, treating alcoholism with affirmations is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. You know what I mean? Alcoholism is much too aggressive to just, you know, I'm not alcoholic. You know, it's just not going to work. So when he gave me this next set of tapes, I was still not really buying into that he's going to have an answer for me. And he gave me these 8 90-minute tapes by a couple of guys from Arkansas. I'm sure a lot of people in here are familiar with Joe and Charlie. And he gave me this workshop. This is back around 1990. And I start listening to it. And the message I'm getting from these tapes is really upsetting to me. Because what these tapes are saying is basically they were saying, "Chris, you know, you're a fellowship guy. You're the pulp of the fellowship. But if you're not in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, actually taking the steps, you don't have an AA program, because that's what an AA program is. So when you go back out, don't tell anybody that AA didn't work. Because you didn't work AA." Now, this is what I'm getting from these tapes. And I immediately have a resentment from people from Arkansas. Okay, because this ain't how we do it in New Jersey. You know what I mean? I don't know what you guys do in Arkansas, but this isn't what we do in New Jersey. But what happened is, a lot of times the truth will haunt you. You know, as you learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to be really upset with a lot of your teachers. In other words, when somebody hits you between the eyes with the truth, the first thing you do is get resentful toward them. You know, but what happens is if you're honest and true to yourself, you somehow have to internalize that information. You have to deal with it. And I had to deal with this stuff that I learned from these tapes. And it started to haunt me. Now what happened, has anybody in here ever had a sober bottom? Like you've been in the barrel in three different ways, and it's just like one crisis after the other, and you don't know if you're going to be able to stay sober or not. I mean, I had one of those things at about a year and a half sober. My choices were put a bullet in my head, drink, or find some kind of an answer that's significant enough for me to be able to live with my emotional condition. So what I did was I went back to these tapes that I was really upset with. And what I did was while I was listening to the tapes, I opened up the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And when there was an instruction for the steps, I turned the tape off, I followed the instruction, and when I was done with the instruction, then I moved on. In other words, what I was doing was I was doing the best I could possibly do at working the exercises out of this book. There wasn't anybody in my area that was doing that kind of a thing when I started doing it in 1991. Now, I had learned one thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how to give good share in meetings. You go to 13 meetings a week, you're going to learn a little something about sharing. Like how to share something that, you know, is humorous, that will make people laugh, and you got to be sure you don't offend anybody, and, you know, you got to manipulate your share just a certain way, a little self-deprecating, you know. And I knew how to give good share, so sometimes the tugboats with the most steam get the tow jobs. So I was sponsoring a bunch of people at this point in time. Now, I'd never been through the steps, but I had a bunch of sponsees. And if you've had that experience, you're going to know that they're going to drink on you, you know? You ever have sponsees drink on you? It makes you look bad, doesn't it? You know? Somebody'd come up, "Chris, is Harry yours?" "Yeah." "Do you know he's drinking and hitting on the new women and borrowing money? I'll have a talk with him." You know? Makes you look bad. So I had kind of gone through the steps. It certainly wasn't a beautiful, you know, completely thorough or masterful run through the steps, but it had achieved a certain spiritual change in me. And these guys that were drinking on me, I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to bring them over to my house, and we're going to open this book, and we're going to do it kind of like the Joe and Charlie thing, and I'm going to take them through the steps, okay? And no one was doing that in my area either, but what had happened was, I'd say about 50% of the guys that started this with me got through. Every single one of those guys is still sober. They're a card-carrying member in AA in good standing, and they're working with other people, and their quality of life is out the roof. The people who didn't go through the steps saw that as an overreaction to a problem they can control, which goes against everything AA stands for. The people who didn't really want to do that, most of them are gone. As a matter of fact, every one of them has gone out of my life. I don't know whether they're drinking. They just didn't stay around AA. I learned a number of things from this experience. One of them is if you want to increase the odds of staying sober for good and all, if you're that serious about this thing, there's one thing I know that works, and I'm not the only one. The other thing that I learned was if you really want to learn something, teach it. What happened with me working with these guys is stuff I didn't really understand or hadn't really done. I had to address that stuff or else I would have felt like a hypocrite actually working with these people. So actually working with these people really increased my ability to work my program. Now, I've always had a sponsor in AA. I've sponsored since I was about 8 months sober continuously. My best friends in my life today are my sponsees and the people that are close to me in AA. And I've been given so many gifts. Now, when I first got sober, I was a bad electrician. Okay, I mean, I was making 20 grand a year, you know, blowing stuff up, and most of my money was going to child support, living at home with mom. You know, it was just awful. And slowly over the course of time, now, I kept my focus on AA for at least the first 15 years. I mean, all I was about was AA. That was first and foremost, the number one priority in my life. And I believe that if you keep this thing number one, all other things will be given unto you. You know, it's like one of those promises that's just unbelievable. Keep your spiritual condition first, and these financial and physical health and stuff like that will come after. And that's the one thing I think I did right, and it's the one thing I never quit, because remember, I was a quitter. And I stayed with this stuff. And so over the course of time, I started to get better and better jobs. In my management career, I went from being a terrible electrician who a 19-year-old was in charge of. I was 32, you know. The 19-year-old was my foreman. That's how much trust my boss had. To the last job I had, I was actually in charge of all the physical plants and all the processes for 80 New York City schools. I mean, you want to talk about an intense job with two phones on each ear, a BlackBerry going off, emails, people freaking out, emergencies every 5 seconds, union negotiations, all of this stuff I was able to deal with. And the one thing I had when I first came in was an absolute lack of dealage. You know? You ever have that feeling? I don't want to deal with that right now. I'm not going to deal with that right now. And you just avoid anything and everything that's potentially uncomfortable, and you go to a liquor store. I mean, that's the way I live. So obviously, you know, there's some benefits in your ability to deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't really go after these jobs. They just kind of found me. Now, about 2 years ago, I was offered by a company called C4 Recovery Solutions to do some startup work with them, and it sounded bizarre, because I was making some Manhattan money, and this was like a startup that if it worked, I'd get paid. If it didn't work, I wouldn't. So it was really rolling the dice. But it was in the addictions. It was in the alcoholism treatment field, which I didn't know a lot about at that time, except, you know, it didn't work for me. But here's the thing. When you get to a point in your recovery, you start to believe in the God's direction and how God shows up in your life. You know, step three basically is a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Step 11 kind of gives you some tools in how to do that. Prayer, meditation, pause when agitated or doubtful, and ask for the right thought or action. Seek God's will. Ask yourself all the time, what would God have me be? What would God have me do? And then get quiet and listen for that intuitive thought or action. Alcoholics Anonymous teaches you how to listen to God. Now, God manifests himself in many marvelous and humorous ways a lot of times. But we're given a skill set to be able to actually listen for divine guidance. And the dominoes had fallen in such a way, so many of these crazy coincidences happened at once, that I knew I had to say yes to this. I had to say yes to this. And what it's done is it's exposed me to some remarkable people. Jeff is one of them. I would not have met Jeff if it wasn't for the C4 opportunity. And, you know, I'm doing some really, really fun things. Economic insecurity is there, but the fear of it isn't, if that makes any sense at all. You know, I'm overpaid in every way in my life except financially right now. But I'm involved in some absolutely marvelous things. If you're new, or you're just coming back, or you have not been through the steps, I know two very significant things about you that you don't know or don't believe. One of them is, you're in way more trouble than you think you are. Alcoholism is a much more aggressive enemy than you're giving it credit for. You know, you may think your problems are coming at you. Your problems are coming from you, and you don't even know it, okay? You're the mastermind and co-creator of all the disorder in your life. I mean, that's how aggressive alcoholism is. But we don't want to, you know, we don't want to recognize it. It'd be inconvenient if it was our fault. We'd have to take responsibility. So recovery and the spiritual awakening is an awakening to that fact that, yes, I'm in a lot of trouble. Without an act of divine providence, I'm hosed. You know what I mean? And that only comes with some experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. But believe me, you're in way more trouble than you think you are. Multiply whatever trouble you think you have by 10, and you'll be getting close. The other truth that I know about you that you don't realize is you're not giving Alcoholics Anonymous enough credit for solutions in your life. In other words, there are more solutions and there's more of a benefit to the AA recovery process than you can possibly imagine at this point in time. There's over 160 promises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of the promises are remarkable. We've all heard the ninth step promises 1,000 times. But there's a ton of really, really great promises. You know, how about the best years of your life are ahead of you? That's one of the promises. How about fear will leave you? Fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter? You're not going to be afraid of death is one of the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's some amazing promises, and they've all come true. They don't all stay true, depending on my participation in the maintenance of my spiritual condition, but they've all come true, and they're all available to us. You know, if you haven't had the miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous yet, the spiritual awakening at depth, the personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism and get about the business of dealing, if you haven't had that yet, please stick around. It is so worth the effort. That's all I got. Thanks.